Another Eastern European who had a way with words will be saluted here in the U.S. this weekend. His name was L.L. Zamenhof, and he invented Esperanto in the 1880s. About 150 people are expected to attend the U.S. Esperanto Conference in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside Washington. They'll be celebrating the centennial of Zamenhof's address to the Esperanto Conference of 1910. Back then, as NPR's Art Silverman tells us, his Washington visit made headlines.
Zamenhof wanted to bridge languages to promote world peace. He stitched together parts of a handful of European languages, simplifying grammar and syntax. That's Zamenhof in 1910, the year he made his one and only visit to the U.S. 6 decades later, in Buffalo, New York, high school student Ralph Dumain taught himself Esperanto on a whim. Today, Dumain is an amateur historian of the language. He says that when Zamenhof came to Washington 100 years ago, it was big news.
Advertisements for Shakespeare's play As You Like It in Esperanto on the theater page. There was an Esperanto baseball game giving, I guess, the rules for baseball in Esperanto. One of the headlines was Esperanto leader faints from overwork, and that was 2 days' worth of news columns.
Back then, Dumain says, the world was ready to accept an invented language as just another man-made miracle.
The phonograph record, the movies, the automobile, the airplane. Things were changing, and Esperanto, in a sense, could be seen by some as sort of some new harbinger of sort of the new world that was being entered.
The 1910 conference was Esperanto's high watermark, but it never went away. After World War I, radio shows broadcast the language, and speakers at the League of Nations used it. By the 1920s, novelists and poets wrote in Esperanto, and about a half century ago, Esperanto even made it to the silver screen.
Incubus, starring William Shatner, is the only film shot entirely in the artificial language of Esperanto.
It's easy to mock Esperanto, but James Ryan, president of the Esperanto Society of Washington, says that to do so is to shortchange Zamenhof's achievement.
Zamenhof's original goal was Herculean. It's kind of like saying, I will build the biggest skyscraper in the world, and coming up with a beautiful, very tall skyscraper, and people mocking you because it hasn't reached the moon yet.
This weekend, it will at least reach Bethesda, Maryland, where the National American Esperanto Conference will take place. Art Silverman, NPR News.
It was another rough day for investors around the world, and today there was a new concern to go along with all the old ones. The news that North Korea was severing ties with South Korea and pulling out of a non-aggression pact sent stock markets across Asia sharply lower. Europe and the U.S. followed suit. The Dow Jones Industrials plunged well below 10,000. But late in the afternoon, the U.S. market turned around, and the S&P 500 index actually closed higher on the day. NPR's Jim Zaroli joins us from New York to discuss the turmoil in the stock markets. And Jim, there have been a lot of bad days in the markets lately. How does today compare?
Well, you know, we're seeing a kind of volatility that we haven't seen in a long time. You know, as you said, we saw a huge drop in stock prices today, although they recovered later. The euro keeps dropping against the dollar. There's also something else happening. We're seeing a rise in what's called the LIBOR rate, which is an indication that banks are getting more nervous about lending to each other. If LIBOR gets too high, banks can stop lending and you have a credit crunch. That's what happened in the fall of 2008 after the Lehman Brothers collapse. You have this plunge in confidence. Everyone's more reluctant to lend because things are so scary.
Now, Jim, a lot of the slide in the market this past month has been blamed on the debt crisis in Europe. Was that another factor behind today's sell-off?
Yeah, over the weekend, the Spanish government seized control of a little savings and loan called Caja Sur. It had a lot of bad debts, and that's made everybody wonder, you know, how many other bad banks are there out there? Spain had a huge real estate bubble, just like in the U.S. You have a lot of banks with a lot of bad loans on their books, and people start defaulting on their loans. You know, it leaves the banks in trouble. It could have a ripple effect throughout Europe, and it would be a lot worse than what we saw with Greece because, you know, Spain is a much bigger economy.
And what about the tensions we mentioned between North and South Korea? Those are a long way from Wall Street. Is this a case of, you know, if Korea sneezes, then Wall Street gets a cold?
Yeah, it seems to have been a factor. I mean, any flare-up in hostilities in Korea would have a really harmful effect on the economy of all of Asia. So that's something to be afraid of. The oil spill in the Gulf is another risk, but I think it's mainly about Europe.
Now, the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the effect that that had on the U.S. economy a couple of years back, is there also a danger that the crisis in Europe could lead us to the same kind of credit problems that we saw back in 2008?
Well, what happened in 2008 was a kind of general seizing up of the credit markets. I mean, banks just stopped lending to each other. And if things get bad enough now, if people get worried enough, that could happen again. I mean, you might say that's kind of a nightmare scenario. At the same time, we're not there yet. Credit has gotten a little bit tighter, but nowhere near as much as it did in 2008. And, you know, there's some question about whether it will. The president of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, James Bullard, pointed out today that, you know, debt crises don't always spread around the world. He said Russia defaulted on its debts in 1998. It didn't throw the world into a recession. He said, you know, it's not certain this will either.
Okay. NPR's Jim Zarroli in New York. Jim, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All along the Gulf Coast, you hear deep-seated fears from fishermen about how long this will go on. Last week, I was in Louisiana's Plaquemines Parish, one of the strips of land that feather out into the Gulf. Most of the shrimping and fishing zones had been shut down by the spill. But at the Dechero Seafood Dock, I found a burly shrimper named Dwayne Baham. He had just come in from one of the last open zones with 800 pounds of very tiny shrimp.
800, baby, all right.
80 to 100 shrimp per pound. These were really young shrimp. They decided to open the fishing grounds early because of the spill. The idea was, get what you can while there's still time. And in fact, 3 days after we talked, that zone was closed too. Baham worries about the oil and the dispersant and the fishery's future.
Well, the worry is your baby stuff, all your little eggs and the little small stuff.
As we're talking, another worker storms by.
Well, I got one thing to say. This is the beginning of the end. That's all I can say about it.
I chase after him to talk. It's the dock manager, Mike Berthelot.
I don't see no more future for us to ever catch fresh shrimp ever again. Oysters, crabs, I think it's over with.
Why do you say that?
For the way they're all gushing out them pipes, and they say it's one thing and it's 10 times that much. But I think I would never trawl or buy shrimp in my lifetime anymore. I'm 51 years old and I've been doing this for 34 years, and I think this is the beginning of the end.
What would it mean for this parish if that were to happen?
A disaster. Hey, you had Katrina, Ike, and Gustav, but you can add all those together and ain't gonna be nowhere near what this is gonna do. Yep.
Nearly 5 years after Katrina, Plaquemines Parish still feels temporary, like it's just barely holding on. New construction, mostly prefab buildings, high on stilts.
We still don't have a school yet here. That's our firehouse. We're using an empty grocery store right now for the firehouse. We still don't have a library here. We still don't have gas service here. We don't have cable here.
I find Byron Marinovich at the restaurant he owns in Buras, Black Velvet Oyster Bar and Grill. This time of year, he's used to fishermen coming in with big, fat paychecks.
Is that nothing to see these guys coming with $3,000, $5,000, you know, just for a couple of days' work? It's the time to make their money. This couldn't have come at a worse time.
Marinovich says his family's been in Plaquemines since the 1860s, fishing oysters. He worked for Chevron for 17 years. The two industries, fishing and oil, have coexisted for generations.
But it's always kind of been a little bit of a love-hate relationship, you know, with the money, with the oil companies.
What do you think about how BP has handled this?
I mean, I don't know. What do you tell people to have 11, you know, family members killed in an incident? I mean, that's definitely the you know, utmost importance. I think they were trying to produce a well too fast, is what it looked like to me. It really does. I think they were trying to get this well in too fast to make them some money, and it backfired on them.
My name is A.C. Cooper, and I'm a commercial fisherman. Been fishing all my life and never worked on a job. Never. I always fish. My father was a fisherman, his father, and my sons. my son-in-law, so my whole family's got a lot at stake right here.
A.C. Cooper is vice president of the Louisiana Shrimp Association. He drives with us to the marina in Venice, Louisiana. The sun is about to set behind rows of trawlers. It's God's country, he says, and then he amends that. Used to be God's country.
Where's y'all at, Kevin?
Out on the dock, Cooper finds his friend Kevin Jury on his boat. Kevin's been working for BP as they go out to take water samples, and he's brought a plastic bucket back with him. At the bottom, it's coated with a thin film of black particles.
That's just a little sign of it that you see. Yeah, once you pour it out, you'll see it running at the bottom a little bit.
How deep was the water when you tested this?
That was 39 feet, I want to say it was.
Wow.
See it in the bottom?
Tell me what you're seeing there.
I see film all over the bottom of it. You can see as I pour it where it's at. And this is in 30 feet of water. So in 30 feet of water, you shouldn't have nothing. All should be on top.
So what does that tell you?
That tells me the dispersion's on it and sinking it. Making it heavier. And what it does, it breaks it down. Like you said, a microorganism is going to eat this. But how long does it take to eat it? At this quantity of all, how long would it take to eat something like this? It may take years. We don't know. They don't know. They can't tell us. I asked many questions and still ain't got no good answers. And how do we boom this? Because everything we have is to catch it on top of the water. There's nothing to catch it under the water. At least on top, we can see it. We can attack it. We can jump on top of it. I don't care how many boats and how many all pads or booms and do what it takes. When it comes underneath, you could be right underneath you, right? And you don't even know it's there. We don't know. But everything else under there knows it's there. It takes the oxygen out of the water and everything dies. So I'd much rather see something I can fight than something I can't.
And what would the impact be, say, for shrimping and for everything underwater?
Oh, it can kill us. It can take everything out of the water. It can kill everything. And where's our eggs going to come from for our future crops? It's very serious. The shrimp is a bottom feeder. He eats on the bottom. If the awl's all over the bottom, where is he going to feed at? He may not eat the awl, but he's going to be eating things around the awl that's contaminated by that. And I hate that word contamination because I don't believe in that. I don't think we're contaminated, but if it gets in there, it may be a problem. But who knows what's going to happen in the future?
You don't want that word contaminated associated with Louisiana seafood.
Shrimp is the best shrimp they have and best seafood we have. Contamination is not it's not even an issue. I shouldn't even have brought that up because it's not. That's one thing we don't like to talk about is contaminated. Because after Katrina, that's all they talked about. And let me tell you something, if you ever eat our shrimp, you'll never eat nothing else. In Plaquemine Parish, 30 million pounds of shrimp comes out of Plaquemine Parish alone. Just a little bit sticks out the Mississippi River here. If you ever eat our shrimp, you'll never eat another one. It's the best and sweetest shrimp you ever ate.
Talk to fishermen in Louisiana, and they inevitably bring up the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. They know that 20 years later, the fishing industry there still hasn't recovered. Commercial herring was pretty much wiped out. And so they look out over the Gulf waters that have been their bounty. They lay boom where they can and watch and wait. This is NPR.
Recognize this voice?
That's the 14 in a row. You know how many minutes of solid music we just had? 48 and a half. Uninterrupted minutes of music in 1 hour. 70 degrees now. The skies are cloudy.
That is Bachelor Jeff Christie, the morning drive time DJ on WIXZ-FM in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, back in the early 1970s. Now, Bachelor Jeff goes by a different name, and he happens to host the most popular radio show in America.
What a day, ladies and gentlemen. Greetings. Great to have you with us. I am Rush Limbaugh, and this is the one and only Excellence in Broadcasting Network, and we've got broadcast excellence for the next 3 hours.
Rush Limbaugh, of course, is much loved. He's also much hated, but no matter what you think of him, it is hard to deny that he is a tremendous influence, and our next guest got some rare access to Limbaugh for his new book, Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One. Zev Chaffetz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You write a book about the personal side of Rush Limbaugh. Are your liberal friends still inviting you over for cocktails these days?
Yeah, they invite me over, and they're curious about Rush. Most of them don't listen and have never listened to him. And so they're interested, I think, sometimes to know what it is he actually says and how it is that he manages to keep such an incredibly large audience.
And I think a lot of people out there do wonder that. What is this guy's appeal? And what would you say to them? I mean, you get into this in the book, but what would you tell people who just don't get it?
Well, you know, Martin Luther King once said, and I hate to be one of these guys who quotes Martin Luther King, but he said...
Go right ahead.
...that 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday is the most segregated hour in America. And I would say that between noon and 3, Monday through Friday, when the Limbaugh show is on, is the most politically segregated hours in America. The country is really divided into people who listen to Limbaugh or who don't listen to Limbaugh.
And so who's listening in that window?
Well, it's as male as Oprah's audience is female.
Interesting.
It is at least as well educated as any mainstream publication or show, and older. Conservative, Republican people, mostly in the heartland, although Limbaugh is the most popular show in most of the coastal cities, including New York.
You know, it's not a secret. I think a lot of people would be surprised about one thing that you tell us in the book, and that's, here we have one of the most heard voices in America, but Rush Limbaugh is actually almost deaf.
No, he's stone deaf. He can't hear a thing. And he went deaf on the radio. I mean, it was a process of some time, but he gradually went deaf. In the last few months of his deafness, he was broadcasting every day. And then he went and got a cochlear implant.
It's an implant that lets him hear something, some voices?
Yes. If you sit with him in a quiet room, face-to-face, you can talk with him easily. He almost never talks on the phone. I went out with him one night, with him and his girlfriend, now his fiance, and we sat at a quiet table, but he couldn't hear a thing.
You also use the word charming to describe Rush Limbaugh, and I can hear more liberal listeners cringing right now. How do you convince them that that's even possible?
Well, first of all, he's different from his on-air persona. He's much less bombastic. He's much less outspoken. In the book, I compare him a little bit to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was, in public, a very bombastic guy. And in private, people say that he was soft-spoken and that his public persona was just a ramping up of his real personality, and that he did the public persona to gather a crowd. And I think that that's very true of Limbaugh also. The other comparison I make between Limbaugh and Muhammad Ali is that they both are natural-born fighters, and they love to take on big opponents. Limbaugh's favorite fights have been with presidents of the United States or heads of the Democratic Party. These are his Joe Frazier's and his George Foreman's.
To keep the boxing analogy going, what would your guidance be to someone who comes to you and says, I listened to Rush Limbaugh for, advice on how to develop my political opinions. I mean, if a lot of what he's doing is for pure politics, I mean, would you say that that's okay? Or would you advise someone to be like, listen to him for entertainment, but find some policymakers, find some others to sort of, help mold your political views?
Well, Limbaugh is both a political figure and an intellectual figure. His view of the world is a view which has educated many millions of Americans. What view is that? The easiest way to put it is to say that it's Reaganism. Limbaugh believes in smaller government. He believes in less government. He believes in the Republican Party as the instrument of that. He's a spokesman for corporate America. He's a hawk abroad. He believes in American exceptionalism. He's less of a social conservative. He's certainly not a member of the Christian right. But I think that it's very important for a democracy to have very clear enunciations on both ends of the spectrum of these kinds of policy opinions.
You argued in a recent New York Times piece that Republican success in 2010 can be boiled down to two words: Rush Limbaugh. And I guess my question is what, if any, risk there is for Republicans following one man, one voice so closely if this is someone who never has to stand for election?
Well, they have to stand for election on Limbaugh's principles.
Republican candidates do.
Republican candidates do, if they choose to. And then they'll be tested. Now, Limbaugh has a mantra: real conservatism wins every time it's tried. By real conservative, he means Reaganite conservatism. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But it looks to me like it's going to be tested in 2010. And if the Republican Party, having moved to the Limbaugh-Reagan right, scores a big victory, I think that's going to be interpreted in the Republican Party as a vindication of Limbaugh's belief.
Zev Chaffetz is the author of the new book, Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One. Thanks so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
If you want to read an excerpt of Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One, you can go to our website, npr.org. If you've got thoughts you'd like to share with us, you'll find us on Facebook at NPR Morning Edition or on Twitter at Morning Edition. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne. Baseball fans of the hardest of hard luck teams, the Chicago Cubs, always swear a brighter day is on the horizon. This season, the man who embodies that hope doesn't swing a bat or wear a glove. Tom Ricketts and his siblings bought the Cubs last fall, becoming the first family to run the team in nearly 30 years. If you're a fan and want to offer Mr. Ricketts your opinion, Jay Field reports he's easy enough to find.
It's one of those chilly spring evenings at Wrigley Field. A multiple-layer situation, with winter hats, gloves, and a blanket just in case. Lily-white bases have been dropped into the moist infield dirt, the national anthem is minutes away, and a man in a blue fleece Cubs pullover can't walk more than a few feet in the bleacher section without someone stopping him.
That's what we like, an owner who likes to hang out in the bleachers.
Absolutely.
The Chicago Cubs are off to another slow start, and the Cubs nation is restless. But you wouldn't know it following Tom Ricketts around.
I appreciate everything you've done for this organization already, honest to God.
All right, thanks, brother. Yeah,
fans here in the bleachers greet the new owner like a long-lost pal, like he's the guy they've high-fived before at some previous Cubs game. Ricketts says that's entirely possible.
I think from the time I was 20 until the time I was 40, I never sat anywhere else.
These days, Ricketts can sit anywhere he wants, but his heart remains here beneath the giant hand-operated scoreboard. It's where he met his wife and dreamed, as he applied to business school, of becoming more than your average fan.
I was cleaning out my desk about a month or two before we closed the deal and came across an old essay, my application, and I was flipping through it and I saw that one of the questions was, what's your dream job? And it was being an owner of a baseball team.
Ricketts, who runs a bond underwriting firm, also sits on the board of TD Ameritrade, the online brokerage founded by his father. The family put up nearly $500 million of its own money as part of the deal to buy the Cubs from the Tribune Company last fall. Since then, Tom Ricketts has spent millions to improve Wrigley Field. He's also shaking as many hands as it takes to reestablish a connection between owner and fan that was lost during the Tribune years. Richard Honak follows the Cubs and teaches sports marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
There's a face to put with the team, and it's Tom Ricketts. And he's gotten out there and he's shown his face to the fans and said, we're going to win. Now he just has to win.
But in the star-crossed world of the Chicago Cubs, where the World Series drought stands at 102 years and counting, that can be tough.
Uh-oh, that doesn't look good.
Florida Marlins outfielder Cody Ross has just launched a towering shot into the Chicago night as Ricketts watches from the owner's box. So far this year, the Cubs win a few, give a few back, and plod along at just below .500. Some fans, like Chad Hickman, have seen enough.
The team's still not performing under the new ownership. I mean, owners can't hit for the players or pitch for the players, so I just think they need to start over.
Ricketts says he never intended to come in and bang heads. He's content to sit back for now and see if the team turns things around. But if it doesn't, he insists he'll make the tough personnel decisions that often follow failure on the field. Cubs fans, he says, are just going to have to trust him for a while. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Chicago.